Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie at Freedom Fest in Las Vegas, and right now we're talking with Jeffrey Rogers Hummel. He's an economist at San Jose State and a historian by training as well. Jeff, thanks for talking to us.
Later.
You have been writing the hell out of monetary expansion and the problems that's causing. What has been happening to the money supply over the past several years?
Well, it depends on what you look at. Let me back up before I answer that question, because I think that what's happened with a lot of libertarians and free market economists is they've fallen into the trap of generals fighting the last war. So the focus has been on how central banks generate inflation. And I think that the concern about inflation is overblown, because the whole nature of central banking has changed, and the financial crisis
Why has central banking changed? Is it because central banks are now competing against one another?
Well, partially it's because central banks are competing. So you have a globalized economy, which means that, you know, when speculators go up against central banks always lose, speculators always win. But also in highly developed countries, in developed countries, you have highly developed financial systems where most of the money that people hold is not created by the government. It's created privately by banks and other financial institutions. And that means that government's seigniorage, the amount of revenue that government gets from creating money, has become trivial. And so that creates a lot less incentive for central banks to increase the money supply in order to cover government expenditures.
But we have been increasing the money supply
massively, right? What happened, but if you look at what really happened is that when all hell broke loose in September of 2008, Bernanke took two steps. One was he engaged in an unprecedented increase in the monetary base, which, other things being equal, would have been highly inflationary. And at the same time, he began adopting a practice that had been talked about before and already adopted by other central banks, which is paying interest on reserves, which, other things being equal, would have been deflationary. And so those two things have actually offset each other.
Why did he do that?
Why did he pay interest on reserves? Well, there are several reasons, and some of them are a little bit arcane. But first of all, ever since the deregulation and the monetary measures began behaving more erratically, central banks have focused on targeting interest rates, and by paying interest on reserves, that supposedly allows them to target interest rates more closely. Then paying interest on reserves is an idea that's been around for a long time, and even Milton Friedman talked about it for different reasons. And it's a way of getting banks to hold increasing reserves and eliminating the tax that reserve requirements or holding reserves impose. So it was a way of helping the banks. And then it also I better not go into it, but the way the Fed runs the clearing system, they want banks to hold the more reserves.
Right. And especially in a crisis where you're worried about them not having enough money and all of that.
And this reflects an underlying change in the nature of central banking. In the past, central banking was about just pumping money into the system, affecting the rate of inflation, and hopefully dampening the business cycle, which we know they didn't do. Central banking has become the new central planning. Central banks are now interested in controlling interest rates, controlling the structure of interest rates, and controlling the allocation of credit. And if you look at the asset side of the Fed's balance sheet, all of the new assets that they've acquired, the fact that they're engaging in this Operation Twist where they're trying to affect the yield on different maturities of Treasury securities, shows that they're trying to influence the and they're also borrowing on the liability side. In other words, in the past, when central banks created money, when central banks bought assets, they just created the money. But now they are also, the Federal Reserve has become a giant Fannie or Freddie, where it actually borrows money on one end and relends it on the other end.
Now, you said earlier that monetarists are fighting the last war, it seems.
Free market economists and libertarians.
Yeah. And so is this the twilight of, you know, we know Keynes is wrong, and but is it that Milton Friedman and monetarist theory in general is no longer applicable to the world
that
we're in?
No, actually, I would say the opposite. Milton Friedman won the debate among macroeconomists about the source of inflation. In other words, in macroeconomics, you have the business cycle, economic growth, and sustained inflation as the three big problems. And on sustained inflation, the Keynesians won't even admit that they ever denied that money was the source of sustained inflation. So that debate has been so thoroughly won that Bernanke is very committed to preventing both deflation and significantly high inflation. So it really reflects the victory on that particular issue of the monetarists. Now, on the business cycle, there's no consensus among macroeconomists whatsoever. And in fact, the recent financial crisis has sort of brought back all of the old debates that occurred during the Keynes versus the classics period of it.
Well, let's get a little Austrian on this. Is it that the business cycle was never properly understood by earlier forms of economics apart from the Austrians?
Well, my take on this, some Austrian economists are not going to be happy with, is that all theories of the business cycle are wrong. And that's why there's no consensus in the profession. When I teach intermediate and graduate macro, I give over half a dozen different business cycle theories. And most of them get at least one variable going in the wrong direction in terms of a stylized picture of the business cycle. So there are weaknesses in all the theories. I think Austrian business cycle theory has some insights, but I also think it has some weaknesses. And therefore, it's a phenomenon that nobody at this point understands perfectly.
We know
a lot more than we used to, but nobody understands it perfectly.
We'll get to fiscal policy in a second, but in terms of monetary policy, what should be the next step if we want to not hammer the economy flatter than it's been?
I think we need to get rid of the Federal Reserve.
Okay.
And privatize the monetary system.
Yeah. Is that I don't want to say because it hasn't been done, it shouldn't even be discussed in the past, but is that a viable option, either politically or metaphysically?
Well, it's theoretically viable, and politically it's not currently viable, but that doesn't mean, in other words, even if you want to figure out halfway measures, you've got to figure out where you're ultimately going.
Yeah.
And when you have a clear idea of where you're ultimately going, that allows you to evaluate halfway
Did
measures.
Did you ever think you would live in a time where you would see college campuses, you know, when Ron Paul or somebody's speaking and they chant like college students chanting "End the Fed," like it was the Vietnam War?
When I was younger, I hoped for that, and then I got older and more cynical, and so I'm pleasantly surprised.
Well, let's talk about fiscal policy. You are been known to say that a treasury default is not only inevitable, but it would be a welcome development.
Right.
Why is it inevitable?
Because the entitlement programs have been run on a pay-as-you-go basis. That makes them very sensitive to both demographic factors and economic fluctuations. They have these huge shortfalls, and this is not just true of the U.S., but it's true of nearly all of the welfare states. And there are different ways of measuring. You can get different numbers, but the shortfall is not something that's happening in the future. It exists already, and it represents...
No, say that now, or explain that, because
okay.
people are going to say, we have until 2030
We have entitlement programs that have made promises into the future, and then we have expected taxes in the future, and the shortfall is between the present value of expected taxes and the present value of promised benefits. And what that shortfall represents is how much either taxes have to be raised or benefits have to be cut, or some combination of the two. There is no other alternative.
Right.
So what I mean by that shortfall being here in the present is that it tells us that the government is eventually going to have to do one or the
but
other.
But won't they do that rather than give up? I mean, this is if we go back to the early 80s and Ronald Reagan, who just 20 years before had talked about Social Security as a horrible big government program. In the early 80s, when he saved Social Security, he talked about it as the one thing we can never.
But the longer you kick the can down the road, the worse the problem gets.
Okay, so this is going to lead to default.
In other words, so you have to consider what are the government's options. One is cutting benefits, and I don't think that's politically going to happen. Raising taxes. Since the beginning of the Cold War, federal revenues as a percentage of GDP have been bumping up against 20% of GDP, which is an astonishing statistic when you think about it, because there have been enormous changes in the tax code and the total bite out of the economy has stayed the same. And even if we raise taxes to as high as they were during World War II, which is the highest federal revenues were, that doesn't get you even to 25% of GDP. And even without interest on the debt, expenditures are projected to go to at least 35% of GDP. So taxes aren't going to solve the problem, partially for the reasons we've been talking about. Inflation is not going to close the gap. Inflation is no more able to close the gap than an excise tax on chewing gum. And the result is that at some point, holders of Treasury securities are going to recognize that these unfunded liabilities are going to affect the fiscal capabilities of the government. And then you have the same situation that happened to Greece happening to the U.S., where you have a rapid shift from a high confidence environment.
And we either won't be able to, we'll pay a massive interest premium on our debt.
Well, interest rates will go up, which will make things worse. So,
yeah.
So things will move very fast. It'll be like the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Well, this is the joke of that, and nobody ever sees an interest, you know, it's like jumping out of a window on the 30th floor and everybody's like, you know, an interest problem, it's fine until you hit the floor
and then suddenly
it's over. Why would it be a good thing?
In the short run it's going to be painful, but in the long run, it'll be a good thing because, first of all, government debt and these entitlement programs represent future tax liabilities, and a repudiation of government debt means the elimination of future tax liabilities, and I think that's a desirable outcome.
Also, because it's like a bankruptcy or a liquidation where we get to start over.
Right, we get to start off, but also it means that you may also see, as government securities fall in value, you may also see, depending on how correctly people anticipate their future tax liabilities, the rise in the value of private assets, including human capital, which will offset the losses with respect to treasuries. The second reason it's desirable is because it's almost a balanced budget amendment with teeth. Unfortunately, that's not completely true, because governments, when they default, often can go back and borrow more, but at least it makes it more difficult for them to do so. And the final reason is I think this represents the Achilles heel of the welfare state. In other words, nearly all the welfare states are facing this kind of fiscal crisis. And I think that once this fiscal crisis plays out, the welfare state will end up being as much a figment of the past as the command economy. And the only really important question is what will replace it.
What would be your option? What would be your preference to replace it?
A laissez-faire economy.
Right. And a night watchman state? Or is even that too muscular
A night watchman state is a modest step in the right direction.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Jeffrey Rogers Hummel of San Jose State, the Independent Institute, for talking with Reason TV. I'm Nick Gillespie.